Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to Pixels. My name is Patrick Beja, and we have a lot of things to talk about today. Well, let's introduce the guests first. That's the thing to do. Kirk Hamilton, welcome. How's it going?
Hello. Thanks for having me. I'm happy to be here.
So, very quickly, before we get into it, and there's a lot of it, you are a former Kotaku. Were you news editor? Right.
I was so many different editors. I was features editor, and then I was deputy editor, and then for a while I was editor at large. That was the last thing that I was, which just sort of meant do whatever you want. So right. I was those three types of editor.
And you are a co-host and producer and musician extraordinaire on one of my favorite podcasts, Kotaku Split Screen. And you're also a musician extraordinaire everywhere else and podcaster. So thanks for being on. Anything you'd like people to check out? We'll talk about it also at the end of the show. But if you have to define yourself with just one thing.
I would say my main project right now is a podcast called Strong Songs that I do on my own, which is a sort of music analysis and appreciation show. That's been really fun. I've been doing that for coming up on a year, and it's been going well. People seem to like it, and that's easy to find. It's Strong Songs kind of everywhere. I think the website is strongsongspodcast.com. But if you like music, you might like that show, so check it out.
Very cool. And we're going to be talking about music a little bit more in the context of video games later in the show. But first, so this show is bi-monthly. Is that twice a month? We do it twice a month. We haven't had a show since the big giant Blizzard Hearthstone Hong Kong China controversy started. And we're going to be talking about that for a little while. We're also going to be talking about the Riot 10-year anniversary stream, which was kind of crazy for a company like Riot, which has developed League of Legends and has had only one product for a very long time. There was stuff happening on the PlayStation 5 side, stuff happening on Fortnite, and a bunch of other things, and of course, games we've been playing. But first, when I first contacted you, Kirk, to be on the show, I was like, hey, I know you like Destiny. You're playing Destiny 2. You're going to be playing the expansion. Let's talk about that. It's going to be fun and relaxed. And then the world exploded in video games.
I feel like that's a very 2019 thing to have happen. Let's talk about video games. Oh, wait, geopolitics has sort of pushed its way into the conversation. Oh, well.
So things, I'm sure everyone listening to this has heard about the basics of the story at least, and I'll summarize the things that happened last week very quickly, and then we'll get into what happened towards the very end of the week, so late that it's almost this week. And before I do that, I do have to mention, I think most people listening to this show will know this, but I did work for Blizzard for 5 years. I was a PR rep at Blizzard Europe, so I have that connection, and I, of course, have multiple talked about Blizzard games in multiple podcasts throughout my 15 years podcasting career, so when I talk about all of this, even though I, of course, try to be as neutral and objective as possible, keep that in the back of your mind. All right, so what happened? The quick summary. There's a Hearthstone Championship that took place during one of the matches, the finals. A player called Blitzchung had an interview after he won the game, he became the champion, where he came out with a statement of support for Hong Kong protesters against the oppression that they're receiving from China. Following that, very quickly and very swiftly, Blizzard banned him for a year and took away his earnings from the entire tournament. The reaction to that was very quick and swift as well, with players everywhere rising up and it's kind of calling for boycotts and calling attention to the issue. Mm-hmm. If there's ever been a Streisand effect, this is a poster story for that. So again, I'm going very quickly. It was kind of the world of video game exploding. Everyone was talking about this and almost only about this. And the Blizzard took about 3 days to respond, which, having worked in that company and in that context, it doesn't seem that long to me, but everyone was saying, oh, how can Blizzard stay silent for so long? That was really funny. It's always like when you know how things work, you're like...
Right.
But anyway, so they ended up coming out with a statement which reduced the ban to 6 months, also reversed the firing of the co-hosts, of the interviewers, the shoutcasters, to 6 months. They were supposedly fired, and giving him back, giving Blitzchung, the player, back his earnings, which amount to about $10,000. And the tone of the statement, well, okay, we'll talk about this in a second, but essentially, people seem to be not very satisfied. Of course, you always hear those who speak the loudest, so that might be a factor of that, but I get the impression, and I'm, you know, connected into the community, I get the impression that people are not satisfied with the revised penalty still. And there's a lot to say about all of this. So I'll ask you first, I guess, Kirk, what are your feelings about this incredibly complex issue?
I can sum up my feelings in one sentence. No, just kidding. This is a very complicated, very complicated topic. Every time I've talked about it, I've always wondered how far back the person recapping the story is going to go. Because you could be like, okay, so let's talk about British colonialism. Yeah. And then, you know, go back hundreds of years. And you never know how long it's going to take. Because, you know, this is a thing that goes back as far, like hundreds of years, to the creation of Hong Kong and the separation and all of that. And I am not a history expert, nor really a geopolitical one. I play video games. But watching this as someone who likes Blizzard games and who is fascinated by video game communities, the thing that it's most striking to me is the way that this particular drama is playing out in parallel to several other dramas with other major brands across entertainment and technology. So the NBA obviously had this huge blow up with the Houston Rockets manager doing a kind of a similar thing and getting in similar trouble with China almost the same day, or maybe the day before the Blizzchung thing happened. Apple has also been running into conflict with China over an app that it published and then pulled and then unpulled and then pulled again. And it's kind of like everyone all at once, at least in America, is dealing with the fact that all of these companies have made these compromises with an authoritarian government in China. And then Blizzard is just yet one more example of this. So most of the mentions that I've seen of this, at least in the mainstream news that I read, like in the New York Times or wherever, will, it'll just be one of many things listed in part of this broader narrative. So it's interesting to look at on its own terms and also to look at how it fits into this sort of broader, into a broader thing and a broader understanding I think people are getting over what was actually given up or what was required in terms of compromise to do business with a government like China.
Yeah, I think just to, I'll interrupt you for a second to comment on this point specifically. I think this is globally, but because of the things that you've mentioned that have been happening, there's a realization of the price to pay to do business with China that for some reason we haven't really had in that manner before. I think some people will say, oh, I've been talking about this forever.
Yeah, I think there definitely have been people, yeah.
Yeah, and I think that's understandable and it's probably fair, but I also think it's important to understand that over the past, you know, 20, 30 years, China has been opening up from a communist country where things were extremely restricted, including on the economic side. And there was a hope, which is not unfounded. It's not like, oh, you were, you know, dreaming some naive dream of betterment, that through economic development, things would get better in China. And I think beyond the fact that it's not unfounded, it's actually happened. You know, the poverty level has the income level and general societal well-being level in China has increased. You know, it was a very agrarian, I'm not an expert either, but, you know, they have gone from poverty to somewhat overdeveloping country. Now they're almost a developed country. So that is not something that can be dismissed. And most of these companies have gone into China in the mid-2000s at a time when there was still this trajectory that was positive and that we were hoping would lead to more and more openness. I think what we're realizing now, which is extremely justified, and it's not like, you know, everything was roses and unicorns in that period, but there seems to have been a shift with the arrival of Xi Jinping, who is now president for life, and the unbearable persecution of the Uyghur minority and the use of technology for Orwellian societies type, you know, social credit and things like that. Those happened, I believe, in the past few years, maybe 5 years. And now we're realizing that shift. So I think it's some important context to understand all of this. And of course, the question still remains, you know, all these companies are paying the price for access to the giant market. I think someone said a phrase that I think is super accurate. It might have been Benedict Evans. China is weaponizing its market. And that's very true. And of course, the other factor in this is that we're used to imperialism happening, coming from without. So even cultural imperialism, you know, America does things a certain way. There's a certain Puritanism or, you know, and you export your culture and you kind of influence other countries through that. That's very natural. And that's something we could expect from China. But what's happening is that they are imposing values because of the access and the investments and everything to outside countries and outside companies, so that they impose those values from, like, not just from without, from China coming into America, France, whatever, but also from within those countries, which is all kinds of disturbing. But okay, that's the general geopolitical context. Keep going.
Oh yeah, no, I think that's very true and very interesting. It does seem to me that also, I mean, the Hong Kong protests themselves have served as a sort of an escalation point for everyone's awareness of this. I think, you know, each of the things that you mentioned, I've learned about in retrospect. You know, I've gone and been reading and trying to pay attention. But the Hong Kong protests themselves are a very visible thing, and you know, I've just been paying attention because protests on that scale and for that long, I mean, that's just something that isn't happening everywhere in the world. And the protests are very organized. They're very good at, you know, staying unified and getting their message out. And so I see those protests and think, oh, okay, I understand this. I understand what's happening. And then that has kind of been the central conflict for each of these, you know, corporate conflicts that we've run into with Apple and with the NBA and with Blizzard and so on, because they all center around someone expressing solidarity with the protesters. So it kind of gives it an angle that makes sense to me, in a way that, I don't know, you know, maybe a Google employee boycotting something they're doing because they're working with the Defense Department or working with an overseas government on surveillance technology, like that can just feel a little bit itemized and harder to follow. This all centers around these big dramatic protests. And I think that also makes this, it brings the whole thing kind of into relief.
Yeah. I will mention that, you know, the things that have been happening in Western China with the Uyghur population, there must be people listening to us now pulling their hairs out, because it's essentially, it's not quite concentration camps, I think.
Yeah,
but it's not
my
far.
Understanding is, yeah, it's not good.
And like re-education camps, and it's, it's, yeah, horrendous. And that has been happening for what, over a year, 2 years? And I talked about it here and there, but no one, I mean, it's a good thing if a video game is bringing attention to an issue that is more general, and we're not going to say, oh, but we were talking about it before, so you shouldn't talk about it now. But so, all right, let's talk about the specific, now that we have everything about the context
we've
explained
laid it all out for everybody.
Perfectly. So what do you think about Blizzard's I guess the initial decision, everyone was in agreement. It's rare that the entire gaming community agrees about something, but I think there mm-hmm. it was the case. The current one, what do you think about 6 months of suspension and money given back, of right. course, after everything that's happened? Yeah, what do you think?
So I think that the initial decision, well, so I personally just like, I don't agree with it. I think you should be able to speak about politics if you're an athlete. I understand it's Blizzard's prerogative to do whatever they want and enforce that kind of vague rule that they have about, you know, no, I don't remember what it is exactly, no offensive speech or something. They can deem whatever they want offensive speech. That's
it's essentially
their
a
right.
blanket,
it's their prerogative.
A blanket
yeah, it's a blanket
that says
statement.
If you do anything we don't like, then we have the right to do anything we like.
Right. And so, you know, I get that they can do whatever they want with that. I think the initial decision, I'm surprised they didn't see the angry response from fans coming. I think maybe they thought no one would notice or something. And then when they got the angry response, to take a half measure and kind of compromise and say, well, okay, we'll give him his money back and half the penalty. There's still a penalty there. And I think what people are reacting to is the idea of being penalized for somebody else's, you know, a different country's restriction on free speech, which just doesn't feel fair. And any penalty probably wouldn't have pleased anyone. So I get that they're kind of in a tough spot. And it is interesting, you know, you mentioned this earlier, and it's something that I've seen non-American commentators pointing out, that America has done this to people right and left. And this is like a very common thing to think, oh, well, we need to change our product to succeed in the American market. And to watch a company like Blizzard in this case kind of doing that, not with its product, but with its people, I think is... in particular, the thing that's kind of set people off. It'd be one thing if Blizzard was doing what movie companies do, you know, where they say, oh, well, we don't want to have a Chinese villain, which apparently is a thing that Disney movies will say, oh, well, okay, or we're going to portray China in a positive way in a certain way because they're a major market. Like, that's one thing, and I think people maybe don't like that. Some people might not like that, but they don't really mind because it just sort of affects the game in some small way or some small representation of a character. But the minute it's people... like, I think that the fact that it was the guy who was speaking his mind and trying to say a thing, and then he was directly punished for it, that just feels so much more clearly oppressive to watch a person have that happen to them. So I think that because of that, Blizzard couldn't really respond to this in any way other than to undo what they did to the guy, because you're watching a person, you know, in a sense, like, have harm done to them for reasons, you know, that people don't really agree with in the first place. And that, I think, is what caused this to feel like such a bigger problem than it would have been if, you know, I don't know, China had called on them to censor a game or change the content of a game.
I think, I want to clarify, I'm not equating what the American Empire was doing.
Oh, no, I know you're not. It's more something that I don't acknowledge enough, and I actually just think is interesting that we, of course, don't think about on that. You know, that's just kind of how the global economy works, right? And it's good and bad, and I don't know, and I'm sure people in America are like, oh, it's been fine this whole time, you know, as it's been happening to other countries, when I'm sure there are also times it's been annoying, but
The closest thing we might think of is when, you know, Facebook has to decide if an image is appropriate for everywhere in the world. And so in France, well, just a boob, it's fine, just show it already.
And, yeah, that's a good example.
And you know, something like that.
And Americans are like, a boob, what? No.
Exactly.
This is the worst thing we've ever seen.
The wardrobe malfunction. And of course, you know, it's like the idea of it can be comparable, but of course, you know, the unbearable oppression that the Chinese people are suffering is not anything similar to that.
So, right. Very different.
Yeah. But yeah, about the Blizzard thing, I think, so let me play devil's advocate for just a second. And of course, this is something everyone's been talking about, but and I understand that talking about freedom against oppression is not the same as saying, you know, for example, Donald Trump is awesome. But don't you agree that they need some kind of policing of their outlets, their tournaments, so that it doesn't become a political circus and every winner starts saying, oh, I hate, you know, Trump, or I love Warren, or... And I know you're, I believe, maybe I'm wrong, you're a somewhat left-leaning person. So I'll say, if someone starts showing up and saying Trump is amazing, let's get the wall built and, you know, stuff like that, certainly it would annoy you. And if this thing with China hadn't happened, I'm guessing you would say, well, this doesn't really have its place in a... But maybe I'm putting words in your mouth.
No, you know, I think that it's easy to imagine a hypothetical scenario where one protest leads to more protests and soon that's all anyone's talking about. I don't think we've ever seen that happen. So I'm sort of skeptical that that's really what would happen. If one person, you know, if a Hearthstone caster or somebody wanted to get up there in a MAGA hat and be like, Donald Trump is great, they would kind of be seen as an oddity, as like a character who's doing this thing. And okay, I guess that guy's doing that. And I, you know, personally wouldn't agree with him and some other people might not. And so other people would agree with them. And like, I don't know if the bridge between that and suddenly it, you know, all of Hearthstone casting devolving into this just political fracas at all times, that just doesn't really happen. Like, it doesn't happen in sports leagues in America either, right? Where people sometimes will say political things. And there's always a feeling of selective, you know, selective punishment. Colin Kaepernick is a really great example of this. This is the NFL quarterback who took a knee to protest police violence against African Americans and was punished and kind of blackballed from the league for it. And a lot of other people say a lot of other political things. It just so happened he was punished for this one thing that he did. So that, to me, I think is more suspect and more damaging when it's the selective thing. There, you know, not every act of political speech is punished. I'm sure there are Hearthstone casters. I don't know this for sure, so I guess I could be wrong, but I'm assuming that they talk about politics sometimes. They talk about world events just during the cast, you know, over the process of playing a game or maybe streaming a game.
I can imagine someone quipping about something or, you know, making a joke, and then I can imagine. I'm sure that happens sometimes.
So this was like a pretty, you know, obviously this was a much bigger and more noticeable thing to have this guy put on a mask and say, you know, freedom for Hong Kong or whatever it was he said. So, you know, I think there's never going to be a perfect way to enforce the rule in the first place. So, and I don't know what the solution is. You know, I understand why they would want to have the rule in place just in case things are really, you know, they're completely losing the thread and no one's even talking about the game anymore. And everything is just like they have to exert some control. It's their product. It's their channel. I get it. But they have to choose what they do. And the fact that there's a Chinese interest and they have this like significant business interest in things, it's not just like they're trying to keep things focused on the game, right? It's very clearly a self-interested business move. And that's the part of it, I think, that people can read between the lines. And so they're like, well, okay, sure, you want to keep it focused on the game. But at the same time, come on, this is about money. This is about your business. And they haven't really said that. I don't know if them being clear about that or saying that would help. Like, I think, you know, people would still have a problem with the decision. But in addition to the decision being questionable, there's also just kind of a layer of BS over it where people know why they're really doing this. And it's not the purity of the game or the cast.
Mm-hmm. It's reading the statement, it's a really difficult thing for me. And I hope
I'm sure you can probably
that I'm not.
Did you ever to write statements like that when you were working at Blizzard?
Well, not quite like that, but we did have a couple of times where things weren't super rosy and we had to write stuff. But I really have an attachment to Blizzard, the company, because I've been with them for so long, not as an employee, that almost has nothing to do with it, but just I like the company. I like their games. I'm not into fanboying, but I want to, there's a feeling of community and joy being part of this group. And so that kind of pools with what I'm feeling about what they did. And reading the statement, you know, it felt very corporate-y. At a time when they needed sincerity. And going over the values, like, oh, think globally, lead responsibly, every voice matters. And they were like, yeah, every voice matters, and we should think globally. Right. And trying to justify those values with this decision in a manner that was incredibly felt completely disingenuous was really hard to, like, it was cringy to read through. And I think... I mean, I don't know if I still know some of the people who work there whom I am certain didn't sleep for 3 days trying to figure out how to message this and what to say. And so anyway, that felt really weird and wrong. And the way they said, I'm going to read that quote specifically, our relationships with China had no influence on our decision. What?
Like, come on.
What are you trying? What are you even like? Just if you don't want people to think about this, just don't even mention it. Like, try to, I don't know. It's like,
This I don't think that would work either, for what it's worth.
I mean, you could say, you know, we try to have everyone speak freely, but in the context of the tournaments, we want to avoid it becoming a political circus. I'm sure they would find a better way of saying this. So we have to have rules, and they could have talked about that, you know, and not say China had nothing to do with it. Like,
I guess, even I don't know though. Like, their messaging is...
Listen.
Go ahead.
I mean, saying China had nothing to do with it is laughable. Even if what they're trying to say is, it's not like Xi Jinping picked up the phone and told us to do this.
So that would be pretty awesome.
The fact that they're in business... it would be cool. The fact that they have a business in China, obviously, like the swiftness and the... Maybe it was the Chinese team or the Asian team that got scared and that took this decision very quickly without calling BRAC, maybe. But still, you can't say that. It's just incredibly difficult. I don't want to be definitive, but it's incredibly difficult to believe that this is a factual statement. But other stuff to say afterwards, but...
Sure. Yeah. Their whole response to this thing is basically impossible. I mean, we're kind of spitballing messaging that they could have done, but I don't know that there's a way. I mean, short of just absolute transparency and saying basically we have, you know, we have Chinese stakeholders in our companies. We do a lot of business in China. It's not good for us to take a political stand on this or for people associated with us to do this. And we're, as a result, we're going to punish this guy and nobody else do it. Like, anything short of that is just not going to work. So there's no way to message around it, because you're like figuring out like the best way to basically mislead people. But like, they just needed to be straight about it. And it's just not a good decision to have to make. Like, they were just in a very difficult spot. And then they had to justify a decision that only really has one justification, as far as I can see.
Yeah, I agree with that. I think they could have, you know, basically given China the finger and said
that
goodbye.
That would have been cool. I'm sure that there are a lot of people who would have applauded that.
Which I'll get to that, back to that in a second. And we're going to get to the end of this segment that's already been quite long. But I do want to mention the
fact
that I want to be hopeful for the future, and this is my love of the games that Blizzard makes that's speaking maybe a little bit there. The punishment now is 6 months for even the harshest political stance you can take. They've established a precedent which says 6 months ban is what you get. And they've actually applied it to the collegial team that also came out in support, in the American team, in support of Hong Kong. And it's funny, the people on Twitter responsible for the team were saying, as expected, we've been banned. And there was a little bit of will they, won't they, for a few days. And in the end, they did. So at least they're consistent there. I guess there's some solace to be taken in that. But it's a 6 months ban. If you agree that there should be policing of political speech on these events, I guess people will argue between 3 or 6 months. Anything less is, you know, not significant. So it's a 6 months ban. I hope Blitzchung will participate in the next Grandmasters for Hearthstone next year, which he has been told he is able to. He was still hesitant on whether or not he would before the reduction of the penalty. He hasn't said if he will or not at this point. But if he does, it means that 6 months from now, we're going to have this guy who was at the center of this entire controversy, who will still be on camera playing Hearthstone and, you know, be there. And which might even, you know, it's going to bring all of this story back again. And he will, the punishment will still be, the punishment permits him to come back and be visible. And who knows, maybe he will do it again, you know, and it will, he will get another 6 months, but it becomes a valiant, I mean, he was expecting that he would be punished for this. So I don't know. I hope that by making the ban this, they are essentially saying, if you do it, you're not going to die. You're not going to lose your money if you do it in an interview, not during the games. It's going to be 6 months that are going to be tough. But if you really feel strongly about something, we're not going to assassinate you in the esports world.
yeah.
So I don't know, maybe that's wishful thinking, but...
Maybe. I mean, I think there's a couple ways this could go, and it'll definitely be interesting to see. I mean, this does feel like a story that probably by the time people are listening to this, something new will have happened, right? This
is a, well, BlizzCon is in a couple of weeks, so that's...
So that will be very interesting. I think there are people planning big protests there. It wouldn't surprise me if some other players did something similar to test Blizzard on this, or did something more extreme to test Blizzard and to see what Blizzard does, so we'll have to see there. Yeah, there's a sort of question of, will he come back? If he does, will he become like this kind of figure that continually references this? And also, the past couple weeks have felt like an inflection point, at least over on this side of the Atlantic, for people talking about this and thinking about this, just like I was talking about at the beginning, kind of in the broader culture and in the broader business world. And that, to me, I don't really know how this will go. I mean, in the end, I guess money talks, and we're kind of seeing some of the interesting side effects of capitalism and global capitalism. But there is I think that it's clearer, at least now, somewhat, than it was a week ago or 2 weeks ago, to a lot of these companies, that there is a cost to doing business with China in these certain ways, or giving an authoritarian government say over what you do with your own internal policies. And I think more people are aware of that now than they were. And that, to me, just strikes me as a good thing, even if it's the side effect of a bunch of bad situations, because it means people know more of what's going on, and it could lead to different decision-making being different decisions being made in the future. But it's something we'll just have to watch.
Yeah, I will say that I think they have to do something before or at BlizzCon. This statement didn't cut it.
You can imagine them just like getting on stage, and it's the sort of wimpy, they don't really mention it, and that would not fly.
If they don't address it, so it's obviously not a good situation either way. But I think if they do address it, then it becomes, everyone talks about it for half a day, and then they talk about the games that they're going to announce.
Right, right.
If they don't, it's all anyone's going to talk about for the entirety of the con.
Right. They come out with I could see some mealy mouth, we believe in freedom around the world, like some vague thing that doesn't mention it, mentions it without mentioning it, and that would probably be disappointing to most people.
I think there would be a way of addressing it without addressing it somehow, some PR ninjutsu. Mm-hmm. For example, there's a Hong Kong team that managed to fly itself to BlizzCon for the Overwatch World Cup. Maybe they could say how happy they are that they're there, or, something to that effect. A wink that China can, like something that's strong enough that it signals the support. But that China,
we're kind of past winking, though, right?
I don't know.
Probably.
But another reason I like the company. 4-5 years ago, I was still working there, and before I left, I sent we were in the summer of Gamergate, and I sent a message, an email to Mike Morheim. I didn't, do that on a regular basis, but I did once, and I told him, hey, it would be really awesome if we could address this, and somewhere in the con or in the opening thing. And he replied very quickly, very kindly, it's not great, but we'd rather let our games do the talking, and we don't want to talk about this ourselves, which I think was a fair enough response. But in the end, I was there like a week after I had left the company, or a couple of weeks, and he ended up addressing it, not saying people are horrible or, they're a-holes, but he said there's a lot of negativity on the internet. We hope you'll be kind to each other and blah, blah, blah. And then Overwatch came out, and through the next few years, they have shown in their games, they have acted upon the things they believe in regards to this issue, which is maybe a little bit less difficult to navigate than relationships with China. But the parity and diversity in Overwatch is undeniable, and I think something to be happy about. Most of their characters now are properly dressed, including the female characters, things like that, which I think makes me think that there is something there at Blizzard that, by the way, very few other companies have actually embraced in that way. Overwatch is a beacon in that sense.
I've appreciated that about Blizzard in general. I think even when Overwatch gets things wrong, which they have, and they they mess up issues of representation, they hear feedback from people, they're remarkably transparent. And I'm not a super hardcore Overwatch player. I played it when it first came out, but I followed Kotaku's coverage while I was still there. They wrote about the game a lot. A lot of my colleagues played a lot, and just Jeff Kaplan, every time he'd talk, they'd run interviews with him and things that he'd say about the game. And I think, there's a sense of watching them process things in real time. And while they do still do things like you mentioned, he mentioned Gamergate, but he kind of didn't. It was like this. It was a nice thing, but it was a little bit one of those don't be mean to each other instead of let's call this thing out.
Yeah, but no one else talked about it.
Right. Unusual, which was depressing on its own. But that's true. And it was something he didn't have to do. And he did it. So, I totally do appreciate it. And so I feel like that's emblematic of this push and pull at Blizzard. They're a huge company. They're trying to do the right thing. And I do get the sense a lot of the time that they're being as transparent as possible when you're an organization that big, making that many different things. And yeah, I think this is like we've said, this is kind of the beginning of a long chapter for them. Yeah. And I'll be interested in how they deal with it, because unlike most companies, they will probably do more of it out in the open than you might think, or be a little bit more, at least like a little more welcoming and discussion about it. So
I would hope so. Yeah. I mean, we'll see. I'll be at BlizzCon in a couple of weeks, and we'll see what happens. But
that's going to be a trip. This year.
Maybe a way to do it is to say, we will make a space within the convention hall for people who want to express their views. You can go there and you can go here, and we welcome
like a cordoned off protest space.
To an extent, I think
that's what cities do. I mean, it's
I think that could say, if you want to say it here, and there's the whole issue of Q&As. Like, you have to let people ask the questions. Q&A is going to have questions about this. And you have to let them.
When everybody
ask
wants
them,
the viral Q&A moment, right? What was it with wasn't it that Diablo game that's coming to phones and that guy asked? I don't even remember the question. I just remember it went viral.
I think it was essentially, is this
are you pranking us?
which rude, by the way, rude someone question. Said it was really, but someone said, imagine if this Hearthstone issue happened last year before they had the BlizzCon with Diablo Immortal That would have been anyway, we'll see what happens. We could talk about this forever, and we already have. So
it's definitely true.
Let's move on to Riot's big League of Legends 10-year anniversary stream and announcements, which was kind of incredible. They had a 45 minutes long stream where they talked about all of the games they are developing. Some of them are very far from release, but some of them are closer, like the card game. They celebrated the community that has made them who they are with just one game until now for 10 years, League of Legends, but pretty legendary game. And they announced,
so to speak,
they announced a console and mobile version of League of Legends, which there are a few, including some made by Tencent, which is company that owns Riot, but it's funny because they went the Heroes of the Storm route, making it a little bit shorter games, more easy to get into, but just for consoles and mobile, which makes sense on those platforms. So that's where they're going. Mm-hmm. The Teamfight Tactics, the Auto Chess version of their game, is going standalone in 2020. They have a card game which is in beta very soon called Runeterra, Legends of Runeterra, with no paid loot boxes, by the way. It's essentially you get loot boxes in game when you progress, and you get targeted purchasable items. There's a tactical shooter, which is kind of the illegitimate child of Overwatch and CSGO. And there's a fighting game, which I love fighting games, and I've been wanting Blizzard to do one forever. But Riot looks pretty cool from what we've seen. And a mystery game, which kind of looks like Diablo, I guess, from the very little we've seen. And a bunch of other things, some animated series, a League of Legends esports manager, where you manage a team. Like, it's a managing simulation. Interesting. Mm-hmm. A ton of things. Love for the community that kind of overflows from this video. I think it was pretty well done. What did you think?
Yeah, I think that it's all very interesting. I am not a huge League of Legends player, or you don't follow Riot super closely, but I know people who have gone to work there just because they're one of those places, they kind of hoover up people from the games press sometimes, people who, were working and needed a gig and maybe their publication shut down. So I've seen people go in there, and my sense has always been that I don't fully understand Riot as a corporate entity, because they have so many people working there and it's not clear what everybody's doing because they just have this one game and the game works. It's a little like Valve in that way, where maybe they're not a black box the way that Valve is, but I've always just felt that way. I admit that I haven't looked super closely. So it's cool to hear that, oh no, actually they're making all these things. And a little bit like Valve announcing a bunch of games would be a similar feeling of, oh, okay, that makes sense. We were kind of wondering what they were doing this whole time, and here's all the things that they've been doing. I wonder if all of these games will really come out. One of the things that I've noticed about Valve and League is they're both kind of one product companies at this point, and they completely survive based on that one product. In the case of Riot, this is League of Legends. In the case of Valve, this is Steam. And as a result, they don't have that same pressure to finish projects and actually ship things. And I don't know, I look at this Overwatch style shooter and just think, really? Like, is that really going to ever come out? Or is that just going to be something that we see some screenshots of and everyone talks about, and then in 6 years, there are articles going up like, whatever happened to that shooter that Riot announced back in 2019? And maybe I'm completely wrong. Maybe it's already almost done and they're about to ship it. I don't really know. But
they made it pretty clear that most of these seem to be in early stages or early stages of development.
Right. Yeah. So, and that's, they have nothing really to lose by announcing that stuff, especially because they're basically doing fine because they have this extremely popular, extremely successful game. So, yeah, I don't know. It remains to be seen whether they need to change. And I guess all companies feel they need to grow and to launch new products. Clearly, this feels like they're on the way to becoming Blizzard, or they're looking at Blizzard and thinking, okay, well, Blizzard has this great kind of diverse roster of games that a bunch of people play and do well for them in different sort of areas of gaming. So why can't we have that too? But I mean, I don't know.
It's even more than that. They have a card game. Well, we'll do a card game. Sure, it's not the way they look at it, but the parallel is striking. They have the card game. They have the shooter game. They have the thing that kind of looks like Diablo. It's just the fighting game that's different. And of course, they have their own spin. But
so one of the reasons I've never gotten into League and have always, I don't know, I'm not very drawn to the characters, the character design, or the world of Riot Games. I just don't find, we would always write articles at Kotaku, someone would publish something about League of Legends, and we have to go find art for it, and they have all this concept art of these kind of generically attractive characters. I'm probably making a bunch of League of Legends fans very angry right now, but I've just never really been drawn into the world or, found it very compelling, where Blizzard through the benefit of having the World of Warcraft and World of Warcraft, but Warcraft itself as a fictional world is actually pretty cool, or the World of Diablo kind of has a lot going on, or more going on than you would think. And I've always been drawn into those worlds. Overwatch, certainly, it lives on the power of its characters and its world design and how you like all these characters so much. I'd be interested if you can just do that, if you can kind of just convert into something like that, because I think that there's a certain, whatever you want to call it, special sauce, I guess, that Blizzard is able to do through their character designers and their writers, that I don't know if you can just kind of magic into existence the way that Riot, I'm sure, would love to. So that, I think, will be a big differentiator, and it's a question for me as to whether, a person like me, I may be a target person for one of these games. Oh, I don't really like, playing MOBAs, I don't like League of Legends, but oh, maybe I'd play this card game, or maybe I'd play this tactical shooter, if there's something that'll pull me in beyond just, oh, it's a good tactical shooter, because there's plenty of those already. Overwatch exists, Counter-Strike Go exists. So I'm curious about that, whether they can do that.
It is very interesting. I think they have their origins in, of course, another, not Twist of Fate, but linking their fates together. Obviously, Dota, which was a mod for Warcraft 3.
For Warcraft,
and that's why you have the generic characters, which are essentially lifted from Warcraft 3, at least in the beginning. But, Blizzard, initially, Warcraft came from a failed partnership with Warhammer, right? And that's why Warcraft looks so much like Warhammer. And through the years, they've managed to build something more. I'm not a League of Legends player at all. I've tried it a couple of times and found it repulsive every time. So I'll be angering the same people as you did. But I think they're doing something really well, which is focusing on their core, hardcore community. And that's mm-hmm. something that Blizzard has, I think, always, not focused as much on. They tried to spread out as much as possible and make it welcoming to a lot of people, make their games welcoming to a lot of people while, catering to the core community. But of course, when your focus is a little bit split, you do maybe one of them a little bit less well. And Riot has been focused on the core community so obsessively that this is what is fueling them. I do see more attractiveness in what they've shown us here. But yeah, it's not an easy thing, and we'll see how much of it is realized. And all of these are probably far down the line. So,
yeah, it's interesting. That core audience observation is a very relevant one right now to what's going on with a lot of these games. We're going to talk about Destiny 2 in a little bit, and that's basically been, that was the constant tension with Destiny, right? Was, do we focus on our hardcore fan base, or do we try to expand and get new people in? And all of these games are kind of wrestling with that. And at this point, it seems to me like the smart play is more, you know, to focus on your core fan base, especially when you're League of Legends and you have millions of people playing your game. Like, it seems to me more like people are doing that. It's, I guess, a more conservative approach in a certain way, but it's saying, we have these fans, they like this game, let's build stuff for them, rather than, oh, but all these millions of people who aren't playing our game, how can we bring them in? So yeah, it seems like that's the approach they're taking, and I'm seeing that approach being taken by more and more games.
Yeah. It's we'll see how well it works for them, or if they end up saying we want to bring in more people.
I'm sure they would tell you that at least. Oh yeah, of course, we'd love you to come in and play.
Come on in. I will mention very briefly that Riot, being held owned by Tencent, has declared that they want no political speech at all.
I was going to mention that earlier, and I'm like, well, we just stopped talking about China. But yeah, that was the least surprising announcement of the week last week when that happened.
It was, so it would be interesting to see what happens if they have to do something about something. But all right. You were talking about Destiny. Let's talk about the games we've been playing. And I guess that means Destiny 2, Shadowkeep, the latest expansion, among other things. But I talked about it a little bit last episode. It had just come out, so I didn't play it a lot. What do you think about this latest version of Destiny?
I think, so what I think about it, I guess, falls into two different categories. There's what I think about the game as a game and what I think about it as a game in my life. And I try to really keep those things separate because, you know, people who really care about Destiny won't be as interested in, you know, the Kirk Hamilton experience of Destiny, even though, you know, my personal experience of the game informed my coverage of it at Kotaku for years and years. And Destiny is like one of the games that I wrote about at that site. I've played thousands of hours of Destiny and I know the game really, really well, and was kind of at the forefront of coverage of it. So I know everything in the story of Destiny. It's just something that will always be, I don't know, it's a game that will always be a part of me. It's the first MMO that I ever became really addicted to, that I really became a part of the community of, and, you know, followed super closely and got a upset about patch notes because they were nerfing pulse rifles. Like, there's, you know, I really care about this game, even though now, you know, the thing I'm struggling with is that I don't know that I have space in my life for it. So that's one thing. But in terms of the game itself, I think it's a very good expansion that is less about the content added in the expansion, you know, the moon and the Eris Morn quests and stuff, and more about the way that Bungie has clearly communicated to their players and will continue to communicate to their players how the game has changed, the new focus that they've placed on it, and the systems that they put in place to give people something to do just forever. Because that's, you know, like I was just saying, they have focused on the people who want to play Destiny all the time, and they've said, okay, you're our main audience, and we're finally going to really give you something in the game that you can just do, and there's always something to do. There's always progress to be made. Specifically, that's like the armor, the new armor system, and the seasonal progression that they've added to the game, which is a way bigger deal for that kind of player than it is for me. But I've come to understand what a big deal that seasonal progression is.
I agree with everything you've said, but kind of.
Okay. Okay, go ahead.
I was a little bit disappointed by the campaign of this expansion. I think they made incredible progress with the campaign of last year's expansion, the Forsaken, which was a genuinely honest to God, good single player expansion, if that's all you wanted to do. And this one is back to the Destiny nonsense. You know, you're like, oh, look, there are pyramids and Eris Morn is crying.
Oh, I like the ghosts, pyramids. Oh. The pyramids were teased at the end of D2. I thought that was cool in the pyramids.
They are.
But I totally hear what you're saying.
Yeah. But what are they? Can you tell me what they are?
No, the darkness. I don't know. They contain the darkness or something. We're going to find out, I guess, maybe.
At some point. That's me. Listen, fool me once. Shame on you. Fool me many times. They've been saying this.
Yeah, but come
forever.
On. You were never playing Destiny for the lore, right?
No, of course.
It's because it's fun to shoot aliens in this game. Like
obviously. I've been playing Destiny since it first released. I enjoyed it very much. But it's just that Forsaken was so good and so compelling as a story and as, you know, going through it for the campaign that I felt let down that they went back to their usual nonsense. Mm-hmm. That being said, the game itself is still just as fun as it was before. Maybe a little bit more. I do feel that the randomness and the added characteristics on armor and stuff like that makes it a little bit more annoying for me because I'm not super hardcore. I played a lot, but I'm not like a raider or anything like that. And now it's like, if I want to quote unquote optimize my stuff, I have to pay attention to 15 more different things, which, to be fair, I don't have to optimize it. It doesn't matter if I'm not into that.
But you want to, right? You feel that, like,
yeah,
you want
that's
to.
The
but
goal.
You, yeah, yeah. No, I'm
but
totally with you
said,
on that. Oh, go ahead.
I do enjoy it, but I guess on this show, I try to tell people if you're, you know, should you be interested in it? If you already are, then yes, it's still just as cool as it was before. And last year's annual pass was awesome. Each season was really cool. We're kind of in the same mode here. But if you're not, this is not going to float your boat. It's if you've already tried it and you didn't like it and you didn't like the shooty stuff, then this is not going to do anything for you, unlike the campaign from last year from Forsaken. But what that tells me is that I'm twice as interested in what's going to be happening next year for hopefully what will be a bigger expansion, because this was way more laying the groundwork of the systems and the infrastructure of the game than actually delivering more content. So we'll see.
Yeah, I feel like that distinction gets at the distinction between the types of players that Destiny is being designed for now, right? Like a player like you or me at this point also, like I would rather play a Forsaken style campaign. I completely agree that Forsaken was the Taken King of Destiny 2 to draw a Destiny 1 comparison. And this is very much the Rise of Iron of Destiny 2,
right?
Where Rise of Iron was the expansion that came the year after Forsaken, or sorry, after the Taken King, and did a very similar thing. It was a sort of a short story campaign that was a little bit ambiguous and then ended, but it introduced a whole bunch of grind and things for people to chase for the rest of the game. This is that on a way bigger scale with the, you know, they've planned out all these seasons and all this stuff. There's clearly going to be a story playing out. And that's, like I've said, you know, I'm drawing this distinction between what the game is for the people who play it that way and want that really grindy, long-term stuff. That's, the game is very, very good for those people right now. But for me personally, like, I haven't played the game in more than a week because I put a whole bunch of time into it over this one weekend, chasing down the rocket launcher. You can get us this exotic quest that sort of, you have to just do a bunch of repetitive stuff to get. And I finished that. It took me, I don't know, a bunch of hours to do. And I'd spent a lot of the weekend doing it. And I looked and said, I can't do this. I have, you know, I'm freelance now. I have all these musical projects I'm working on. Like, I need to be practicing guitar. Like, I can't. And, like, I'm just much more aware now that it's not my job to play and write about Destiny, that I'm spending time that I need to be spending on other things playing this game, and this game that will happily take dozens and dozens of hours and just munch through my evenings if I let it, because it's such a, you know, engrossing time sink. And so, yeah, I'm definitely with you on that. It would have been cool to play more of a single player campaign, but that's kind of what the game is going to be now, especially now that Bungie is solo and has broken free of Activision, because they don't have the support studios making the game anymore. They had, what, High Moon and the other studio who helped them make the PC ports and make the Mars expansion. I think Warmind was almost entirely made by another studio. They don't have that anymore, and that's very evident in what they've done here. There's a lot of clever stuff happening in Shadowkeep, repurposing of old assets. Every boss is a nightmare boss that's really just an old boss from Destiny 1 that they could just bring up to Destiny 2. And you get this feeling that they're, you know, cleverly reusing assets. There's this really funny scene at the beginning of the campaign where you're on the moon again, which the moon is a Destiny 1 location, and the Hives show up, which are one of the same enemies we've been fighting for seriously, what, 5 years now? Like, they still haven't introduced any race other than the Taken. And the Taken were actually just...
Well,
even the Taken were... The Scorn, but the Scorn were kind of just fallen.
So there keeps
being this feeling, and then these Hive come up, and Ghost says to you, "These aren't the Hive." And it's like, okay, come on, guys. Like, I'm shooting thralls in the head. These are acolytes shooting at me. They're Hive. Like, I get that they're a little different, but they're still Hive. So Bungie is working with what they've got, and there's a sense that, you know, everyone always, I think, hopes, oh, and maybe the next expansion will be this big thing, and they'll, you know, release this, something really wild will happen, a whole new race will crash to Earth. And it seems to me less and less likely that that's going to happen, because now they have fewer resources than they used to, and they're creating a game that instead is just more of a kind of, you know, long-term, it is what it is. It's you shoot these kinds of aliens, and it's really fun, and you chase these weapons, and every now and then we introduce a new weapon. But it does seem like they're struggling, understandably, to create as much content as people want. There wasn't a weapon refresh. You still get the same weapons from, like, every vendor. So it's still all the same stuff you've been getting for years. And there's just this sense that you can tell they're making it work as best as they can. But I wonder if that'll really change in the next year or two, or if it's going to kind of be this sort of a thing for a little while.
Oh, you're making me worried now.
Sorry.
I really hope they're working on something, like they diverted resources from this one to work on mm-hmm. the next one. But yeah, I guess we'll see. That being said, I was disappointed by the campaign, but I'm still pining to play it more. And I've been very busy these past 10 days. I haven't had time to play enough. But just like I have for the past 5 years or 6 years, I really enjoy the shooting aliens in the head.
Yeah, that's the magic of Destiny. It's fun to shoot stuff in that game, and so it never stops.
Exactly.
And it's cool that it's free now too. You were mentioning new players. Mm-hmm. I think it's been interesting. One of my co-hosts on Kotaku Split Screen, my other podcast, Maddie Myers, has been playing the game, the free version on PC, which is like New Light, and I think it doesn't have Forsaken, but it's like all the year one stuff. You can just kind of play. People could try that, and I think they'll immediately get a sense of, oh, it feels very fun to shoot aliens in this game, and this is a pleasing game to play. But I think that it doesn't explain itself at all, and there is this sense of, this is just this massive systems and goals and quests and nothing. Everything is just thrown at you at once in this smorgasbord, and that does seem like it might be kind of alienating for people.
I think it's very.
It doesn't explain itself either. There are no tutorials or explanations.
To the point that I'm not sure I would recommend it. I mean, some people have tried it and enjoyed it, but I'm not sure I would recommend it to new players. I was listening to Split Screen, I think, a couple of weeks ago, and Maddie Myers, your co-host, was explaining her experience, and she was like, "Oh, it's the first time I'm playing an MMO, and I didn't realize it was so obtuse and confusing." And I was listening, and I was like, "No, MMOs aren't like that. It's just Destiny.
They aren't all
just
right.
Completely
right. There's some sort of onboarding usually. Just Destiny throws you in the deep end if you start. It is free, so I guess people can try it for free. And there's that. But yeah, I think it is not entirely welcoming.
My worry would be that people try it with this version, get pushed off of it because they don't understand anything that's happening, and then don't get the joy of the head alien shooting thing that we've liked for so long. So yeah, get out of this what you will for your decisions about Destiny 2 Shadowkeep. You've also been playing Sayonara, Wild Hearts, and Disco Elysium, which I'm curious about.
Yeah, so these are two fantastic games that I've played that I wanted to tell your listeners about. Sayonara Wild Hearts is a Simogo game that's on PS4 and phones and Switch. Have you played this game, Sayonara Wild Hearts?
I downloaded it when Apple Arcade launched. I played it for a little bit, and then was distracted by all the other games.
Yeah, that kind of happened to me too. I played it a little bit and was like, wow, this is very, very good. And then stopped and then came back and played the whole thing. It's about 90 minutes long, so it's not super long. And it is fantastic. I am over the moon over how good it is. Simogo is a very, very small indie outfit. I think there's almost two of them. They're Swedish game studio. They made Year Walk and Device 6, fantastic games. They made Beat Sneak Bandit, which I had forgotten about. This is an older phone game that's this great little puzzle stealth music game. Their games are very polished, very good, and this one is on another level. It's kind of like an running, racing, res style, stylized music game. It's described almost as a pop album game. So there's this killer soundtrack. It's originally recorded by artists who've worked with Simogo before. So it's new music, but it sounds familiar. It sounds a little like that band Churches, anyone listening to this likes Churches. It's this very like drenched, thick electronic pop music with female vocals, gorgeous stuff. And you're playing as a young woman who had her heart broken, and she kind of falls into a parallel dimension that's maybe symbolic. and she's kind of rediscovering aspects of her personality and like conquering adversity to rediscover herself. And so you fly through these fantastical spaces. You know, one minute you'll be actually flying through the air, kind of guiding yourself. I play with a controller on phone, so I liked the game with a controller better than with touch controls, but it plays pretty well with touch controls too. So you're like dodging things and trying to pick up gems, and then you land, and then suddenly you're on a motorcycle and you're driving and you're trying to hit gems, and then suddenly you're like riding a deer, or you're flying through the air, or it gets really wild, you know. There's all kinds of different vehicles and scenarios. And there are these boss fights. Each boss that you're fighting is this kind of very cool looking person who's challenging you in some way or another. And the whole thing is queued up to this music. And it's beautiful looking and constantly shifting. You know, the perspective, the camera never stops, you know, never cuts. And it's just from behind this woman's shoulder. But she'll go flying through, you know, a wall, and the camera will pull back around. And then suddenly the perspective is completely different as the music changes. And it's really just this kind of synesthesia experience of just music and visuals and gorgeous ideas. And it's very clever. The challenges are very clever. It uses this one button input very, very cleverly. And by the end, I was really, really overwhelmed by this game. Like, the ending is beautiful. It's a masterpiece, really, like a little mini masterpiece. Wow. And I loved it so much. I just can't recommend it enough.
I love how animated you get when you talk about it. You have the video on Skype, and I can see you getting joyous talking about it.
Man, it really knocked me out. I loved it. So I hope anybody listening to this, if I get one person to play it, especially because you can get Apple Arcade and like play it for no money at all. I almost want to buy it, though. I want to buy it on Switch or something just to give these people some money.
You could.
Though I guess they got some money because I played it on Apple Arcade. I guess no one really knows how that works yet. So that game is very good.
I do have a couple of questions. How much do you think you're enjoying it because of your love of music, first of all? And second, how much of a game is it rather than experience? Is there, you know, gameplay in it, or is it really just you live through the thing?
So the first question, definitely a lot of the enjoyment I'm getting is because I love music. But, I mean, it's a really wonderful looking thing. If you don't like music, you might not like this game. Who doesn't like music?
Exactly.
It's a very appealing, you know, beautiful thing. And so, yeah, for me personally, the fact that I'm over here on Skype freaking out about it, yeah, it's because I love music and I love what they're doing, and the way that this game communicates musically, I think, is just fascinating and beautiful. But it's just really, really cool. And the music is a big part of it. It is a musical experience. You wouldn't want to play this without headphones. To the second question, it is very much a video game. It's not a very long one, but it's a very dense one. And, you know, it's one touch inputs for the most part, but that can translate into a lot of different kinds of gameplay. It's very old school arcade in a certain way. A lot of it is dodging, you know, blocks that are being dropped in your way by the boss. It'll be kind of a mix of needing to thread through a bunch of fast moving obstacles, like kind of like a racing game, mixed with there's some fighting, but a lot of that is just button taps that the game prompts you to do, almost like QTEs.
A rhythm game or?
Oh, a little like a rhythm game, yeah. So it's like a mixture of rhythm game, steering, driving game, and then there's some aiming at a various part. You get this cool bow and arrow, and you're kind of like tapping on things to kind of blow them up as you're moving. So it's very, like I've said, very shifting. So what you're doing at any given second even can be completely different than what you were doing before. When you die, it kills the groove on the music and backs you up a little bit, and you keep going. You don't lose lives or get a game over. But it does screw up the flow, and that, to me, is the worst punishment of all, when the music is really going and you're soaring through, you know, these really cool neon city streets, and then suddenly you hit a building and the music just stops and you restart. It's a very harsh punishment. But yeah, I would say if you wanted to get gold, so you get rated on each level, and it's very steeped in the language of video games. You know, you finish and the voice will say, bronze rank, you know, and like it does that kind of thing. And you get a bronze or a silver or a gold. I would say trying to get a gold on every single level would require a lot of practice and a lot of repetition and going back to it. I know people who have done that. So if you want to get that kind of arcade game experience out of it, you absolutely can. And it's very well designed in that way. For me, I mostly just played all the way through it, and it was like an experience, but it was one that required skill. The last level was tough. I died a bunch of times. So it's not just kind of watch these pretty things while this music plays. You have to interact with it and demonstrate skill and kind of keep up.
Sounds very cool.
Yeah, it is.
We'll talk about Disco Elysium in a second. I just want to mention, first of all, I definitely am going to play Sayonara Wild Hearts now.
Yeah, you'll dig it, I think.
I also played, I was traveling, and I finally tried What the Golf, which everyone has been raving about.
That game is amazing. I was just playing some of that last night.
It is kind of incredible. And I, as everyone has been saying, I don't want to spoil it too much. It is kind of a golf game and not really. It's more of a, like, the elements of golfing that it takes from other games is basically pulling, you put your finger on the ball and then you pull back to have the strength and then you let go. And that throws the ball. But that's the only part. Like, you don't have to do things in a certain amount of... Or if you want to go for ranks...
Occasionally, there's a par, yeah.
Yeah, a par and stuff like that. But really, the experience and the density of the game and the cleverness of the way the levels are designed. Everyone knows, I think, that initially you tap the ball and then you tap the guy that's throwing the ball and then you tap a house.
Right, that's kind of the first trick, yeah.
Yeah, and that's really nothing about the game because the way it finds ways of having you enjoy doing that simple movement of pulling back and then releasing is kind of amazing because of the gameplay elements and also because of the interesting references and almost narrative around all of it. It's like you can feel that someone had a clever idea and then they actually built a full product. Like, it's not just the gimmicky thing. It's everything that it needs to be a real gaming experience. So I was very impressed, and it's a lot of fun.
Yeah, that game continues to exceed even my understanding of what it is. The fact that they have that overworld, you're kind of in this test lab where you're a golf ball moving through a test lab, which feels a little Valve-y in its design, you know, a little like Portal. And then you're going into these different test rooms, and then each one has these wild different rules. Is a really smart framework for the game, I think. And yeah, have you gotten to the Nintendo reference? I don't want to say what it is, but...
I have gotten
I just last
to...
night played this hilarious Nintendo reference that
I have
very,
gotten
very
to a number of, yes, I
okay.
have.
Which so is... There just is this continual sense of, oh, I get what they're doing here. And it's so funny. Also, I don't know whose voice it is, but the guy who it's just one guy's voice and he's kind of singing and talking and he does all the voices is hilarious. Like, the way that they use his voice and they use even just the sound files will just start playing. Everything that you'll do will be accompanied by him going like, making some sound. And it's a very funny game. There's a feeling of just continual punchlines. Like, you're constantly, each new one, you think, oh, what's the joke going to be? And then you start laughing because it's not what you were expecting.
The way they manage to surprise you with the mechanics, and like, that's the thing. I think you play the first couple of levels and you think, well, you know, I've seen the game. I understand what it is. And the way they manage to, with each new area, to reinvent or like completely go outside of what you thought the game rules were, even with all the variations, at least to the point where I am now, maybe it gets repetitive afterwards, but they keep like... It's almost like they keep thinking, they create a box where you think, well, this is the rules and this is how you play. And then next level, they go outside this box and you're like, oh my God, that's so clever. They're thinking outside the box. But then they're like, it's an infinite number of boxes they keep going outside of. So very, very cleverly done.
Yeah, it's quite a game. I'm a big fan as well.
Yeah. What the golf. And finally, Disco Elysium. I guess
Disco Elysium, that's the game. So this game is a total trip. I talked about this on Split Screen this week as well, and I've only played a few hours of it. I've played a little bit more than when I talked about it with Maddie yesterday, so I have a slightly better sense of it. But this is one of the most interesting role-playing games I've played in years, and I didn't see it coming at all. I'd heard a little bit about it and seen screenshots of it, and I thought that it was going to be a kind of isometric PC RPG, you know, like Divinity Original Sin 2 in that kind of vein. And I think it's an interesting counterpart to Divinity Original Sin 2 in this kind of resurgence of PC RPGs, but it's very, very different. And the best way I can describe it is to say that it's the most purely role-playing focused role-playing game I've almost ever played, at least played in a very, very long time, and that's what it's all about. So I'll maybe talk about some of the specifics, but that's the thing to keep in mind is what this game is about is you can role play in a world full of consequences, even internal consequences of decisions that you make in a way I've just never seen before in a game. All right, let me try and describe it to you. Have you read about this game at all? Okay, that's good. Because I'm assuming listeners maybe won't have heard of it either. This game is kind of under the radar. All right, so it looks like an isometric PC role-playing game, and I think it's only on PC. It's on Steam. And so you're, you know, your little guy walks around in these really intricately beautiful, you know, beautifully drawn 3D worlds viewed from an isometric overhead perspective. You click on things, you talk to people, you have conversations, you play a role, you go through a story, you make decisions, the story branches and reacts to your decisions. So it's that kind of a deal. It's closer to an adventure game in some ways, to like a point-and-click adventure game, than to a really chewy role-playing game like Divinity, partly because there's no actual combat system. There is combat in the game, but it's all played out through the same system of like stat checks as the dialogue. So it's, you don't, you know, there isn't a whole separate combat system. You don't level up combat skills specifically or get new guns and like they become more powerful. It's not that kind of game. It has a lot in common with Planescape Torment, which will probably perk up the ears of any like old school PC gamers listening to this. It feels to me a lot like playing Planescape in the way that there's a ton of text. It's a very text-based game. It's almost like interactive fiction. As you walk around, there's just a whole lot of writing. There's voice acting for some of the lines of dialogue, but it's the thing where like people will talk for a little bit and then it'll just become all text and you'll go through very long conversations with them of just reading. So you do a lot of reading in this game. And it's set in a kind of a steampunk city that's its own original setting and is very interesting on its own, or I'm at least drawn in by it. It's a very seedy place, and you're this detective in the police, in like the police force, but it's kind of like a corporate police force or a volunteer police force. Not clear what's going on and like how this city works. You wake up, you're super hungover because you were just drinking and you almost died, and you have amnesia. So your character is this kind of deadbeat cop with amnesia. And it's helpful because you don't remember anything that's going on. So there's this feeling of kind of faking your way through every conversation because you're not sure what you're supposed to be saying, but everyone's treating you like a cop, like you're supposed to know what's going on. The game itself is all built around these stat checks. So there's a lot of text, you're writing and talking, and as that's happening, you're seeing stat checks for like your conceptualization skill, or you know, your the skill that governs your sort of how your composure skill. You know, there are all these different skills that you have, and they tell you extra information that you can use or not use in the conversation that you're having. And the result of this is that there's a sense that your character is this sort of systematized organism. It's your character is constantly thinking and having stray thoughts and like delusions of grandeur and being distracted and or remembering something because he has a photographic memory and remembers things super well. And that's all factoring into conversation. So it simulates the conversation in this very dense way that I think is very different depending on what kind of character you're playing. Like you choose at the beginning, I chose a character who's very smart, but he's not very insightful or very brave or physically fit. He's just like a very smart guy. So he remembers a lot of things and has a good sense of, he can recreate a crime scene when he sees it, and that opens up different options for me. So using those skills, then you role play with all these conversations, all these characters, and apparently it goes in a million different directions. This is a game where you're apparently not supposed to exhaust every dialogue option in every conversation because doing so could make people angry with you or lead to unexpected repercussions down the road. And it's much more like you have to treat it like a simulation. And on top of all that, well, I don't want to get too sidetracked with all the systems, but basically the result of that is that you feel like you're role-playing in a tabletop game with a real DM. Like, it feels like I am able to just choose all these different branches in conversation and role-play this thing in a way I never have in a game before. And the last thing that I'll explain, I guess, is the way that your thoughts and your internal monologue work. You have a whole thought system where if someone talks to you, like I was talking to this guy who's a super racist guy, and he was explaining, he's like from another island and thinks that his race is the best. And he was explaining to me his race ideology. And as a result of that, that is now something that I can dwell on, and I kind of assign it to a part of my character's subconscious. And he'll dwell on this guy's race ideology and over time be able to speak it to the guy, which I think will then make that guy like me. But the downside of that is it will make my character a racist, which I think then will lead to outcomes that I can't predict. Like, my character will do things that I don't want him to do, or he'll, you know, say something racist to somebody. But it's kind of this interesting simulation of how an ideology might work. There's a whole system for that, for thoughts and for things that you're dwelling on and kind of keeping in the back of your mind that then kind of come out in unexpected ways. And you'll even have conversations with your senses and your thoughts. Like, I was out and, you know, suddenly my rhetoric skill just pops up and I have a conversation with it as it says, well, you know, that guy made some interesting points. And so I say to him, like, well, what do you mean? And my rhetoric skill is talking to me and it says, well, you know, you could think of it this way or think of it that way. And I have this option to accept what it's telling me and then move in this one direction or not. So it's a very inwardly focused simulation where you're this person, basically. And like I said, I've played 4 or 5 hours of it, maybe 3, 4 hours. I'm really impressed with it. It's not like anything I've ever played before. Could be it all falls apart from what I've seen, the coverage of it that's been very, very positive. It doesn't, and it is as good as I think. As I think that it is, but it's a trip. It's quite a trip of a game so far.
This is kind of hard to wrap your head around when you're...
It is. It's kind of hard. It's hard to explain. Unless I just like monologued for a few minutes trying to explain this, and even then it is difficult to nutshell for people.
So how much would you say of the game is outward, and how much of it is like the character... fiddling with its
mind and
emotions, and yeah,
I'd say it depends on how you look at it. I mean, you're walking around in this beautiful looking world, picking things up, interacting with the world, so it's largely outward, but okay. Every aspect of conversation or really interaction is mirrored or like followed along with by your internal monologue. So it's happening kind of parallel in a way that feels like you're a person, in the same way that you or I interact with the world. When we walk around, we're always thinking, our brain is always on. We're always having distracted random thoughts of things or analyzing things or jumping to conclusions about things. And so it's always kind of there humming under the surface. And then occasionally it comes to the forefront when your brain sort of says to you, hey, what about this? Like, do this. And then you really have that conversation. Mostly you're just talking to people, investigating, being a detective, trying to solve a murder, and then just kind of constantly under the surface, your brain is doing all these different things depending on what stats you have and what kind of character you're playing.
Okay. It seems like a very original, different system for that kind of game that we've never really seen before. So
yeah, it's very ambitious. I think the people making it have been working on it for 15 years, I believe. I saw an article, which is kind of shows when you start playing it, like they've been trying to come up with a system for this because it feels kind of radical. It feels like a radical game in some ways. Like they're really trying to just throw out the idea of what an RPG is, that sort of The Witcher, Fallout, okay, this is how an RPG works. You just follow these rules and you get what it is, and do something completely different, which is one reason it's hard to explain. You know, if I were explaining a game that was like The Witcher, like Horizon Zero Dawn, I could say, yeah. Oh, well, you know, it's kind of got a little bit of Witcher, a little bit Ubisoft game, a little bit of Assassin's Creed. You get it. This game is a lot harder because it's like, well, it kind of reminds me of Planescape. It kind of reminds me of a point and click adventure game, but it's not actually, you know, it's its own thing. It's this new thing, which is exciting to play in 2019 when there aren't always that many new things to play.
Very interesting. So that's Disco Elysium, and all the games that we discussed will be in the show notes if you're interested in trying them out. A few additional bits. There was some news around the PlayStation 5, including the fact that it will indeed be named PlayStation 5.
Definitely the most exciting news was that it will be called the PlayStation 5.
You know, I know a lot of people make fun of this and it's like, oh, of course, what is it? But you don't know, and it is still...
No, I'm not fully kidding. I kind of mean that. I always enjoy finding out what the names are going to be. I'm very curious what they're going to call the next Xbox. PS5 is a little less surprising, but Xbox, Xbox 2? What are they going to call it?
Xbox, I think it's going to be Xbox. My money is on Xbox, just... Mm-hmm. Xbox is the thing.
That wouldn't surprise me.
PlayStation 5 will have a bunch of little things that weren't all that surprising. Let's focus on the one that was at least a little bit interesting. The controller will have adaptive triggers and haptic feedback, which the reporter at Wired that had the exclusive thought was very convincing, which I don't think I would have gave this another thought and thought it would have been gimmicky if the reporter wasn't saying, actually, it works. It gives you a different feeling when you're in a, you know, playing a racing game and the car is over asphalt, or when it's in the mud and stuff like that. So the idea would be that there is some kind of tension that's created within the trigger so that it's harder to pull or keep pressing. If you're using a bow, it will be harder to pull the arrow. It's simulating it like that. I think there's something interesting there. I don't think it's going to, you know, change the entire experience, but could be fun.
Could be cool. It seems like the kind of thing that might malfunction very easily. And there's also sort of the question of like whether everyone will use this, or this will just be like a PS5 exclusive thing. This is something Microsoft ran into with their, you know, the trigger rumble on the Xbox. Like, people do that for Xbox games, but there aren't that many games outside of the world of Xbox that use it. And so it feels like maybe it'll be a cool thing on the occasional PS5 exclusive, but less, not a ubiquitous thing. Unless maybe Xbox does the same or something similar with their controller, and then it could become more universal, which would be cool.
Maybe, yeah, that could be something I would enjoy. I mean, if they make it easy enough to adapt it to, it could, it's not like, I don't know, the Kinect, right? Because Kinect, you have to actually design it with that in mind. But if it's easy enough to say, well, for this type of weapon, you have this type of tension that's created, it feels like something that could be included into existing games more easily than some of those other gimmicky things, like even, motion control or the stupid
Yeah, and I love this kind of stuff. Like, I love haptic stuff in controllers, so it sounds like it's probably pretty neat. And, we'll see how it works, I guess.
It will be released holiday 2020 as we expected. There are a couple of conflicting reports / rumors. One says, essentially, Sony has been saying backwards compatibility is not guaranteed, like not 100%, which is like, wait, what? I personally think it means like some functionalities on some games is not guaranteed to work. I think backwards compatibility is still pretty much a given. And the other thing is, it seems it might be backwards compatible with every generation of PlayStation 1. That's a little bit more of PlayStation since PlayStation 1. That's a bit more of a rumor, but it could be interesting, especially if they're, it could be cool.
Nice. That would surprise me, given that PlayStation Now, I mean, maybe PlayStation Now isn't working for them and they don't want to do that anymore. But given that they have this subscription service to let you play those old games, if they then kind of also, it just seems like it might kind of eat into that, into the people using that service.
No, I mean, if they allow you to install the games, because with PlayStation Now, it's streaming, but you can also install PS4 games. So if they say, well, PlayStation Now, we have, old generations, you can stream them or install them. And so you have a choice and do whatever you want.
Oh, I see. Yeah, it could work. And also, I mean, it would be great. I'd love that. And I would be pretty surprised if you can at least play PS4 games, particularly given that the PS4 is the first console where you've been able to buy every single game digitally and download it that way. Like, if you can't just download your PS4 games to a PS5 and play them, the anger over that would be so significant, and I would be shocked if that weren't the case. I think what you're saying, that maybe there will be some things that won't work or some small features that might carry over, the occasional odd game that might have a problem, that seems more likely to me. You never know. I mean, Sony has done stupid things in the past, so they could do something stupid here too, but I would find that very surprising.
Yeah, I'm thinking like maybe the touchpad, the new controller doesn't have one, so you would have to have
right. There's some other
or something like the PlayStation Eye, is it, the camera?
Oh yeah,
stupid little thing. But so we'll see more info. I did find it interesting that they dumped all of this info now. I guess it must be because developers must be receiving the controllers through the dev kits, so they want to control the information. But also, it might be because they want to focus on the games when they finally open the floodgates. But
Yeah. I don't really know why they would have done it, but seems like they've made the calculation and they've made the announcement.
Yeah. I think it's all about controlling the message and not having the thing.
Right. Kotaku scooping them on and posting all the stats or specs on the thing.
I got my Oculus Quest last week and,
I don't have one. How is it?
It is a lot cooler than I thought it would be.
I've heard.
I've had a couple of virtual reality headsets, the PlayStation VR and the Oculus Go, which was very disappointing. But the Oculus Quest works really well. It's a little bit heavy. It gets, not huge amounts of battery life, like a couple of hours, 3 hours. But the everything else about it, from the design, like not infrastructure, but experience point of view, is incredible. You design your safe area very easily. The games just, the graphical capability of the device aren't stellar, but they are more than enough to give you a convincing experience. The touch controllers, which is what was, the six-axis thing, is what was missing from the Oculus Go. And the feeling of presence is so dependent on having your hands that you can see within the world and being able to move your head around. And it works so well with this thing. It's still a little bit pricey, I feel. But if you can connect it to the PC and it works with the announced, you know, Link functionality so that you can also use it to play Rift games, I think it will be a great way for people who are interested in VR to give it a try with no reservations. I think we're at a point where it actually is compelling. There aren't enough games or experiences so that I can recommend it to people who aren't interested to begin with. But if you are, really, really compelling.
It's very smart that they've made a system that now works both as a plugged-in Rift and as an on-the-go device, only because that turns everyone who owns one into a potential, you know, demo operator for VR. You know, you can bring one to a party, and then it's just so much easier to bust it out in the living room while everyone's over and say, hey, who wants to play Super Hot? And then everyone's suddenly playing this really cool VR game and finally gets to see the real thing. Like you said, the hand controls. I remember reviewing the Oculus Touch when those controllers came out and saying, oh, okay, this is the real thing. Like, this is the VR experience that Oculus has been working on this whole time, not just the Rift headset. And that's definitely true. If you give people who've never played a VR game that at a party in the living room and let them play for 5 minutes, they'll probably walk away with a much more positive view of VR, which seems to me to be what Oculus's challenge and also their goal. Like, they've identified that as the challenge. Most people see VR and think, I don't know, man, I can't buy that. I don't have time to play that. So that is a smart move on their part. And then also, just like you said, I have a Rift here, but I don't use it that much. And it's kind of a pain to set up. And, you know, like being able to just put one on anywhere, draw boundaries, and then play something, like that seems nice as a player. Just that seems much more convenient.
Yeah.
So that's cool. That's cool to hear that it's good.
Definitely. And what's impressive is the know-how that Oculus has acquired through, you know, years now of trying to do that. And it works flawlessly. The experience
they're very
is
good.
Really, really well designed. I would say we're still like a third of the weight, a third of the price, a third of the ease of use away from it.
Yeah. It's not the finished thing yet. Yeah. Whatever that thing is going to be, the device that everybody gets, not even close. Like, it's just, it's another, but it is an important step. This step that they've taken is a cool one.
And I hope the Link thing works really well. We'll see.
Yeah, I hope so too. That's a very cool feature.
I got into GOG Galaxy 2.0, which I think is under NDA, so I'm not going to talk about it too much.
Oh, okay, don't break any NDAs here.
I will just mention that it does the principal function that it promises really well. Like, having
this is it unifies all of your PC games in one place, right? That's the idea.
Not just PC, that's the thing. It does PS4. You connect all of your accounts, including PlayStation, Xbox, Ubisoft, like all of them. Not Nintendo, I guess.
Of course, Nintendo had to be their own thing, of course.
Yeah, of course. But then you have a giant library of, you know, however many games you have, and you can filter them, search through them. Like, I realized I had some games three times that I didn't on different platforms. Like,
oh, that's
it's
funny.
Really compelling.
Yeah, Nintendo wouldn't want to do it because then you would be reminded constantly how many times you'd bought Earthbound.
Or how few games you have on Nintendo platforms.
Right. Do,
maybe. So that's pretty cool, but we'll talk about it more when it's I'm sure it's not under NDA.
And interesting.
Quick round of additional games. News. Stadia has a launch date. It was the most tame announcement I've ever seen for something like that.
It's there. Stadia's, but that's been Stadia's MO this whole time.
Yeah, it's true. I mean, it just confirms to me everyone's idea that this is not a launch. It's a beta that you have to pay for to be a part of. And the real launch will be when it will be available free for everyone.
That will happen. I'm very just remotely curious about Stadia. We'll see how it goes, but I'm not probably going to be using it.
You know, so the date is November 19th, but in Paris, we have a company called Shadow. Maybe you've heard of them. I think they came to the U.S. recently. They essentially give you a remote PC, an actual PC that's running that they beam they stream the video to you, and you control it with, you know, your keyboard and mouse, and you have apps on other devices. Mm-hmm. And I constantly have been trying it out every time I'm in Paris every few months. And I did it yesterday, and oh my God, it's so good. It's so good now. Hmm. It, like, the latency, I swear to you, is not noticeable. Like, of course I have fiber, but I have like a 4 right. milliseconds latency to the shadow servers, and I played Overwatch, of course, and they have like a 30 milliseconds latency to the Overwatch servers. So the total, let's say 35, is less than I get when I connect to the Overwatch servers.
Nice.
It is really, there are other issues, it's not for everyone, blah, blah, blah. But the latency, which is the main issue we talk about when we think about these things, I swear, people who think it doesn't work are people who haven't tried it properly. And this is a small, well, it's a startup in France that's existed for a few years. When Google and Microsoft are going to be doing it, it's going to work a lot better. So
that's cool. Yeah, I'd love it if it was great. I think that would be a great twist on the story, is all this skepticism is unfounded and Stadia turns out to be amazing.
Well, I don't think it's going to replace your PS4 or 5. It's just going to be the thing, not Stadia itself, mm-hmm. but streaming as a technology. You have a PS5, you want to try an Xbox game, well, you don't have to buy an Xbox, right? That kind of thing.
Right. Yep. Yeah, it makes sense.
Fortnite did, like, they continue breaking all of the rules. Like, they took the game down for 2 days. I'm sure it was masking some kind of server upgrade or something, but it was so clever. The game was inaccessible. The game was sucked into a black hole and you couldn't play it. And then it comes back with a new map and new functions. And you, like, it's funny. I was talking to a friend who has 9-year-old twins, and they were talking to him and they were like, oh, Fortnite is finished. I guess we have to find another game to play
because it's game. Oh, well, that's it. Black yeah, hole 8 Fortnite. Game over. That's funny.
But yeah, the ingenuity and the cleverness of Epic on this game is continued to blow me away. It's like, who takes a game down for 2 days and builds an event
the person
it?
In first, right? It's nice to be on top because you can do stuff like that. And it's cool when someone takes advantage of their position on top to do something like that because they know they can. That's been my main takeaway. But yeah, I think it's pretty neat too.
Miss Marvel was announced for Marvel's The Avenger game. That's coming out in May. Mm-hmm. Well, it's very minor, but I did want to mention it because, first, I love Miss Marvel, and she was represented very well in the game, and her powers are weird. She, like, embiggens her limbs and herself. It's very strange, but it worked. It seemed to work in the game. But beyond that, this game has been criticized because the models of the characters look like the stunt doubles of the actual actors from the MCU.
Right.
And I think that's a fair criticism, of course, but Miss Marvel, who hasn't been portrayed in real life, in live action by anyone, is perfectly fine in the game. And we see her and she seems like, you know, Kamala Khan. So I think mm-hmm. there is a little bit of that. Everyone else will be fine and maybe we'll even get used to the characters we know from the MCU. But Miss Marvel is really cool in that game.
Yeah, I had the same thought of basically, it's cool to see a character in this game that I don't have all these associations with, even though I'm with you that I think probably, assuming the game is really good, if we play 30 hours of it, we'll get used to this version of Iron Man and this version of Black Widow, etc. But yeah, agree. I don't know Miss Marvel super well as a comic character, but she looks really cool, and it was neat to see as something new, kind of, that doesn't feel like one of the movies.
Yeah. Iron Man VR is coming in February, and people are apparently saying it's good. So I'm looking forward to that. I'm a Marvel fan, if you haven't realized.
Nice.
Doom Eternal delayed to 2020. Not only that, March 2020, at like a month before its release. Not only that, but they're pushing some of the features from the game away from the release. So I think they need a bit more time to polish it. And it's good that they're taking that time. But yeah, maybe the release date was a bit ambitious.
I think it was Rami Ismail, the developer on Twitter, said rip and tear, but not crunch, apparently, which I thought was a very
funny joke. I didn't see that. That's very cool.
That's a good joke.
So maybe the No, but it's interesting. It means that, you know, Crunch is part of that conversation, and they decided
we can assume so anyway. Yeah. I mean, the game probably wasn't ready too, but hopefully more and more developers are also saying, and we don't want to kill our employees to get this thing done on time.
I guess, you know, if they knew where they stood 4 or 5 months ago, they could have crunched to meet the date, but maybe they decided we're speculating here, but yeah, it could be cool.
You don't really know.
Yeah. Red Dead Redemption 2 is coming to PC. Not a big surprise since we have the Rockstar launcher, but we saw a video and oh my God, does this game look good? Already looked good everywhere else. But
yeah, I think back to when GTA 5 hit PC and that game also just looked completely bonkers. Mm-hmm. And yeah, I liked Red Dead 2 and will play it again on PC. I think it's, you know, I've been looking forward to playing it at a very high frame rate and looking very smooth and very good. And actually like taking my time. I think when I was reviewing this, because I was reviewing that game and that was a whole thing. My review was a whole thing. And I mean, I have mixed feelings on the game for sure, but I really thought it was impressive and pretty cool for the most part. And playing through it for review was, you know, I had to kind of keep going. And so there were things I missed and I didn't rush by any stretch. I played like 70 hours or something, but it'll be nice to play it again. I always say that it's better. Like the second time through a game is always better. And it's so cool to play this kind of a game where you can just take your time, really sink into the role and into the world. I know what happens. I don't need to get to the end. I can just play and go really slowly and just do side stuff and explore. Cause that's the richness of the game, I think, is really there. So I'm really looking forward to playing it on PC.
Well, I would argue that taking your time in this game is not really a choice. They make you take your
That's true. It does confound you when you try to rush through it. I guess that's why I didn't rush. Though I just skipped some side stuff, you know, and like didn't do every single little icon on the map. And I will probably do that this time through.
Very cool. There's a bunch of other things. I think we're going to skip through some streaming
stuff. So much news.
Stuff
too much
on
news.
Steam and xCloud is available, and there's some cool toxicity blocking stuff on the Xbox platform, which seems to be very cleverly implemented. Call of Duty Mobile has 100 million downloads without China within the first week. Kind of incredible. It's the biggest downloads ever.
Yeah, people and, like Call of Duty.
People, you know, you wouldn't have guessed. Although, the impressions, I haven't played it myself, but people are saying, people who enjoy it on PC are saying it's pretty good on mobile as well, which I would never have thought.
Yeah, I've seen some positive impressions of it.
Yeah. And there's a fake Game Boy coming out, the, what's it called? I can't remember.
I can't remember. It's neat looking, though.
Analog something, analog pocket analog something. Yeah, it looks cool. I'm not into retro stuff, so it's not my jam.
Yeah, like I don't need to replay Game Boy games. I'm good. But it's a neat looking little device.
And that is it for this episode of Pixels. Thank you very much, Kirk, for being on with me. Where can people find you and what you do on the internet?
Well, they can find me on Twitter at Kirk, K-I-R-K Hamilton. They can find Strong Songs, my music podcast, at strongsongspodcast.com. And it's on Apple and, you know, it's on a bunch of podcast services. And Kotaku Split Screen is at kotaku.com. And that's also on most major podcast services. So that's me. And yeah, thanks for having me, man. This was a pleasure.
Yeah, indeed. I'm very glad. I now have two of the three co-hosts of
All right, you're almost
screen.
There.
Almost.
Nice.
My collection is almost complete. For me, it's Not Patrick on Twitter, Facebook, and Instagram. And you can find this show at frenchspin.com. And there's another one over there you might enjoy called The Phileas Club, where we get people from different countries of the world to get together and talk about events and give us their take from their culture about those things. And we even talk to people we disagree with. Like last episode, we had people from the UK, Scotland, Ireland, and the UK. And there was a Brexiter in there. And we had a civil, interesting conversation. So
imagine that in 2019.
I know, right? Frenchspin.com for all of that. Thank you very much for listening. Next episode, I think, might be the BlizzCon special, which will be its own shade of interesting as well. But we'll be there and we'll report. And it will be fun in parts. Talk to you then. Bye.
Hey, marketers. Want a matchmaker to set you up with your perfect audience? Well, look no further. Get intimate right away with host-read sponsorships with Acast. Use Acast's self-serve ad platform to search and partner up with a podcaster or two from our network of more than 100,000 shows. Have them sing your praises in their own words. And get their listeners ready to be wooed into loyal customers. It's the ultimate loving endorsement. Book host-read sponsorships with Acast. Head to go.acast.com/closer to get started.